It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And my name is Ben Bullen.
Hey Ben.
Hey Scott.
Hey, I got a topic today that I want to talk about that this one kind of close to my heart because one of my favorite cars, if you remember, we went back, going back a long time ago, we did a top 10 favorite cars of all time podcast. I think my number one car was a Lotus 11, if I remember correctly, and I'm sure I do because it still is one of my favorite cars. So I want to talk about a little bit about the founder of the company that put that car together.
Right. And when we talk about this fellow, Colin Chapman, we'll start, let's see. You want to do it, let's do recounting style. We'll start at the beginning. We'll go through the middle. And then when we hit Lotus, we're really telling two stories, but it is, this sort of thing is very fascinating to both of us. And it's difficult to talk about Lotus. Some would say impossible. Unless you're talking about this guy, their stories are intertwined.
Well, you have to.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, but I guess overall, I want to point out too, though, as we go through here, we both came up against this kind of wall, where we decided that there's so much information.
Yeah.
There's so much detail about this guy and his history, and it's so storied and so, so complex at some points, that to get all of this out in a short podcast, we just can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much to do with the Lotus model. So if you're expecting a complete rundown of every Lotus model,
engine
stats and all that, you know, we just can't do it today.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to give people a good feel for who Colin Chapman was, Lotus as a company and what they meant to the motoring world and to motorsport and what they mean today.
Yes. Along the way, we'll meet several notable characters also in Chapman's life.
Mm-hmm.
So let's borrow Tech Stuff's Wayback Machine, and they have a Wayback Machine.
Really?
Yeah, it's over here. Let's hop in. We're going back to 1928 near London, where a young, precocious man named Colin Chapman is born. And now let's see. We know that Lotus Engineering Company gets its start in 1952. So I'm going to go kind of briefly up to some of that.
Sure.
Okay. So, when he was studying in school and college, he learns to fly, to pilot planes. He gets a degree in civil engineering.
He's in the Royal Air Force.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Yeah. After he gets his degree in 48, he becomes an officer flying with the Royal Air Force. Good call, Scott. And then the way I've heard it phrased a lot, he starts messing with cars. He starts building cars.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, when he starts building cars, as a lot of car builders do, he does it because he wants to compete. He wants to race.
Yeah, here's the thing. He started – I'm sorry for chiming
in
here.
No, no. Yeah, chime in.
He starts this when he's about 19 years old, Ben.
Yeah, he's a young man.
He received this is kind of like, I think it was a Christmas gift that he received. It was a 1937
the Austin 7, right?
No. This is the Morris 8 Tourer.
He
had, and this is his first car. Mm-hmm. Not the one that eventually becomes, you know, his first heavily modified car But, you know, of course he had this love for machines, and mm-hmm. I think he had a motorcycle fetish for a while, and you know, of course he loved airplanes, and that design, you know, that's going to come into play later.
We see that echo down.
His love of airplanes and what they're all about. Mm-hmm. But there's kind of a funny story that, you know, when he was young, he was attending London University.
Yes.
And he would, you know, have these other two students that he'd give rides to school. Hazel Williams was one, and a guy named Colin Dare. Mm-hmm. And Colin Dare was just, you know, a friend of his from class, but they would, they'd be passengers in his car, you know, his new 1937 car. Yeah. It wasn't really new at the time, but, you know, cause this is like, 1945 or so. Mm-hmm. Maybe even a little bit later. But he decided that he was going to make it kind of a sport to get to and from the university.
Yes.
And he would try to find out the fastest route, or he'd try to cut down on his time to and from different locations. Mm-hmm. And of course the passengers are terrified, but you know, it becomes fun.
I imagine
a lot of fun for him. So, I don't know. This led to kind of an interesting relationship between Colin and
that'd be Colin Chapman.
Oh, Colin Chapman and Colin Dare. Now mm-hmm. the two Colins, of course. Yeah. And they started up what I guess is kind of like a used car business.
Yeah, because basically one of the ways that they would cover the finance of this, right? The Colin Chapman would build a car mm-hmm. and demonstrate how well it could go, right? To sell it.
Yeah, he'd take a used car and he would modify it in some way. He didn't necessarily build a car from scratch at this time.
No.
Not at the time. You know, they're still at school and they're still, you know, trying to make their way through university and, you know, mm-hmm. trying, you know, everything goes along with that. But, it is 1946.
Mm-hmm.
There's very few cars available in London at the time, in Europe at the time, really, because, the British government has a
moratorium,
rationing.
Right?
Yeah, there's a rationing for petroleum and
steel.
Very few new cars available. So the used car industry was a hit at the time. It was a big mm-hmm. boom, and they kind of tapped into that on a really small scale. They were mm-hmm. they were selling or buying and selling between one and two cars every week between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And it said they sometimes skipped classes in order to make sure that, you know, like these deals went through.
In order to hustle those cars, man.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an interesting thing that, you know, they finally got up to the point where they're making, you know, decent profits because they're modifying the cars, make them stand out a little bit more.
Right.
From the competitors. And, you know, but I think it was like 1947 when they did away with the rationing, finally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Britain did. And, they had one car that was left over, one single vehicle. Now, that was the one that – this is a 1937 Austin 7.
Yes, yes. The Austin 7 that you hear different things about this car, but eventually, if I can let the cat out of the bag, he decides to enter the Austin 7 into some trial races.
Yeah.
And
Not yet a Lotus.
Not yet a Lotus. We're almost there, guys, but not yet a Lotus because, Colin Chapman, after he decides, and I get the sense that this wasn't like his main priority. This was something he maybe decided to do for the heck of it or for fun.
Oh, yeah. He's an engineering student.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's also in the, military. He's in the Royal Air Force.
Yep.
And of course, he's got this this love of machinery and, mm-hmm. and how things work, and you know wants to kind of figure everything out. And one of his things that he's interested in, of course, airplanes.
Yeah,
they're all about lightness. They're all about dependability,
weight to power.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he kind of falls into this this method of building cars. He says, well, you know, if it works there, where can I mm-hmm. Draw that over into the automobile? Which at the time. It's kind of an unheard of thought.
Yeah, people weren't thinking it. I mean, there were some other luminaries of the automobile world working with those kind of concepts, but it was far from the norm.
Exactly. You know? Now, even in as far as British cars goes, you normally think that, you know, a British car is a small, light, sports car looking, because that's the way impression we get around the world, I guess, is that you think of the MG, mm-hmm. you think of the Triumph, you think of the little cars. Up to that point, really, in British car history, cars were kind of heavy. They were kind of slow. They weren't
more
really,
stately.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, exactly. They're more stately. They weren't particularly aerodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't what we think of today.
So Colin, right, he has this Austin 7. He tries some trial races and boom, he is addicted. He is looking for different, parts of the regulations that he can mess with, you know, loopholes, if you will, to get an edge.
That was his big thing, right?
That was his huge thing is, you know, what can I get away with? Where's my aha?
Sure. So and, he's in British road car racing, really.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And at this time, he's also, working, like, to keep his car building operation afloat. This is probably after his schooling stuff. He's working with the British Aluminum Company.
Okay.
And what he's doing there is he's not just working there. He's also volunteering and he's also bartering with the company to get parts for building things. And because, you know, of course, the situation at the time is really difficult for him to get some of these parts, so he does have to resort, even if he had a lot of money, he would have to resort to some sort of bartering deal or.
So he's got a pretty intense day job as well at the time.
Yes.
And this is more of a hobby still.
Yes. Until, not unless, but until 1954, my friend, when Colin Chapman says, forget the day job. I'm taking this full time, baby.
Good for him.
Yeah. And, I'm devoting all my time to Lotus Engineering and Team Lotus. That would be Racing Team Lotus.
Very good. Very
I don't
good.
Know why I have my hands raised.
I don't
like
know
that.
Either, but you, you're signaling a touchdown, it looks like.
I was into it.
So yeah, he's actually pretty successful in some of the smaller, Formula series. I mean, he's raced in, the 750 Formula series, not Formula One. We're talking about some of the smaller series that lead up to that. But, you go back to 1950, that's where he raced in his first race.
Yeah.
That's at Silverstone. You know, it was a road race ahead of time, but, that's where he entered and won his first race. And that was, I'm going from the historic Lotus Register, it says he took on a Type 37 Bugatti and won. And that's not, any small feat at
the
time.
Yeah, there's no small beans.
No, no, not at all. Now he actually was a winner in the 750 Formula Series that I mentioned earlier.
Yep.
That was in, let's see, just a year later. This is after he had met two brothers, the Allen brothers, Michael and Nigel. And, you know, of course, at the time he's working on, you know, just working by himself in his girlfriend's garage.
Yeah.
Cause he doesn't even have a garage apparently. Mm. But in 1951, he entered the 750 Formula Series and won every single race that it finished.
Every single one.
And with the note that it finished.
Yeah,
exactly. So it must have had a couple of times, you know, where it crashed out or what, you know.
Sure.
Mechanical
failure, component
whatever.
Problem.
But as long as he kept it running, he was winning that race in 1951. Mm. And, even, you know, against cars that were, you know, double the engine size.
Sure. By people who didn't have day jobs.
Exactly. These are people that, you know, all out racers, and he's just a guy that's, you know, showing up for the track on the weekend.
So let's be honest. When we say this unequivocally, Colin Chapman at this point in his life is beating people with numerous, handicaps on his own ability to maintain his vehicle, mm-hmm. on his time. You know, this guy, when you come down to it, is exhibiting a type of focus and determination that's relatively uncommon.
Incredible skill.
Yeah.
Incredible skill, really. And, you know, this very shortly leads way to, and I'm going to go back just a little bit more,
yeah.
Ben, the Lotus Engineering Company, because I mentioned, the brothers, Michael and Nigel.
Right.
The Allen brothers.
Mm-hmm.
It was with Michael, and, you know, of course himself, Colin, as the two directors of the company, they formed Lotus Engineering Company in 1952. So, you know, 1952 is when the birth of the company began.
Right.
Started, really. But
2 years later, he's able to quit his day
exactly.
job.
Exactly. And that's when – and tell you what, Ben. In 1954, he was beating the Works Porsche team with a 1.5-liter car that had an MG engine.
Which is just crazy.
It's unbelievable. I mean, this is in – you know, this is, again, another sports car race at Silverstone.
Sure. Yeah.
This is prior to the Formula One race, but it's a big event. It's a big venue. And he's beating the Porsche Works team.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's a pretty incredible story, really. I mean, it had to have just boosted his confidence like you would.
Oh, yeah. And it's advertising that you cannot beat with a stick, because we also see Lotus Engineering. Like, can you imagine you're looking for a race car, Scott, and then you're thinking, who is this dark horse candidate just lapping people? Yeah. I mean, he's probably lapping a couple people.
It's rare to see something like this ever. Today, I would say it's – I mean, maybe there's an example out there, but I can't think of anybody that would show up like this and be able to run with so little backing, I suppose.
Yeah, to run with the big dogs as an independent.
And now by 1955, now we're going up just another year, he makes his debut at Le Mans.
Which – has not happened since.
No.
That kind of evolution had never happened before.
No,
happened since.
No. It was actually, you know what, here's the thing. They didn't win at Le Mans. They were disqualified. I guess Colin was at the wheel, drove through a sandbank or something like that. Off-road excursion is how they put it, I think, in the register. And he backed the car out. He reversed it out of the sand trap instead of going forward, and they disqualified the car. So, unfortunate, but that's what happened. And, you know, still by 1955, you're debuting at Le Mans. That's not bad.
Yeah. And, by what, 1958, they're building Formula One cars?
Yes, and another thing.
Yes.
They are building, and I'm going to scramble some notes here, but they are building my favorite car, the Lotus 11. And, you know, they're building for sale the Lotus 11. So, you know, it's competing in the sports car series and everything. Sorry for the papers, everybody, but, Steve McQueen bought a Lotus 11 in 1959.
Wow.
You can find photos of this car online. It's the number 33. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Steve McQueen, big actor. You know, we've talked about his cars in the past.
Right. Yeah.
The movie roles.
Notable car collector.
He actually traded, he had a 58 Porsche Spyder. A Speedster that he traded for it, you know, to get into sports car racing. But, he owned and I guess loved this Lotus 11. Which is kind of unusual for him. I mean, this is a relatively, you know, new vehicle on the market. For McQueen to back this thing and actually use it in competition, I think that says a lot.
Yeah, it does. It's the kind of praise that you can't get unless you deserve it. And while we're talking about racing, here's one of our cameo characters we should probably mention, right?
Sure.
And you know who I'm talking about.
I think I do.
Well, let's see if Scott's powers of prediction are correct, because, my friend, I am going to mention Jim Clark.
JC.
JC.
Maybe not the JC you were thinking of, but
possibly
JC.
Not the JC you were thinking of, yeah.
JC.
So Jim Clark, I think it's fair to say that Jim Clark is one of the crucial reasons for Lotus Racing's success.
I think so. And he's a he for a while was I guess kind of a household name, really.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, because he's an F1 – well, we'll talk about it in a moment. But he's an F1 champion. Mm-hmm. He's winning over here in the States.
Yeah.
He's Colin's best friend, which is unusual. We'll talk about that too. But also there's something that led to one part of the Jim Clark history leads to some major innovations in Formula One, and we'll talk about that too. But
yeah.
Let's talk about Jim Clark for just a moment so that we get an idea for who he was and how he plays into this whole thing. He was a very, very talented racer. I mean, he's one of these guys that had the shining.
Yeah, you know, there we go. That's a good way to say it.
He's just outright talented. He was originally a farmer. He's born in 1936. He eventually became he became a world champion,
an F1 world champion driver
with Lotus in 1963 and in 1965.
He was driving the Lotus 25.
Yeah, that's right. And he had, you know, 25, interesting number. He had 25 Grand Prix wins overall in his career. And he also won the Indianapolis 500 in 1965. So that was a big year for him.
Yeah.
Be an F1 world champion driver and win the Indy 500 in the same year. And just as a side note, in 63 and 66, he was also finished second in both of those races in the Indy 500.
Oh, okay.
And let's see, he's also a member of the inducted in both the International and the American Motorsports Hall of Fame. So that's unusual, but probably one of the craziest things about this now, I mean, the great, great driving history, of course, right?
Right, yeah.
Something really unusual that happened here is that he befriended Colin Chapman, and that's something that just didn't happen very often.
Yeah, and let's describe these people. You already have the sense, hopefully, listeners, that Colin Chapman is a guy who makes things happen. He's a driven individual. He's very good at working with systems. He's a little more outgoing, although, you know, he has been accused of treating people superficially.
No, but he's incredibly focused.
Yeah, but they don't – Jim Clark does not look like the kind of person, especially on paper or if you met them together, doesn't look like the kind of person who would be Colin Chapman's best friend.
No, you wouldn't think so. You think the two would mix like oil and water.
Right, yeah, really? Because we've got this guy from Scottish border country, that's Clark, and he's from farming land, and the one thing they have in common, man, they both love racing.
Yeah, they both love fast cars, and they both know how to talk to each other in order to get the most out of a racing car. And
yeah,
that's important. They've got this real, real. I hate the word synergy, but I guess it's a great synergy between the two.
Yeah,
of them.
It may be appropriate. They've both got the shining, and both have the shining about the same thing, that's all you need.
Well, he could tell him what he needed from the car, and then Chapman could make it happen, and then they could fine tune it, and then it's perfect.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the way it went through his whole career, through Clark's whole career. And you know, it's interesting that, you know, they became friends, and here's this guy's the youngest champion ever, youngest world champion ever in Formula One. And I don't know, they just seem to like each other. It's just really uncommon for Chapman to really warm up to anybody like this.
Right.
It just didn't happen.
That's
just
the thing. Chapman was known, I won't say notorious, but it was no secret that he had sort of a wall with people. And it's very strange that Jim Clark, on the offset, a cursory glance would tell us it's strange that Jim Clark would become such a good friend of his. But if you think about it, the stuff they do have in common is easily the most important thing in each individual man's life. You know, like Colin Chapman doesn't just build cars. He has driven them. And he has raced. So if you're Jim Clark and you're talking to Colin Chapman about something that's weird with suspension or whatever, he can hop in the car and he will figure out what you're saying.
Exactly. He can respond to it. He can tell him exactly what he needs.
They speak each other's language.
Exactly. Now, I guess we'll get right to it here.
Yeah.
We've talked about the storied racing history and everything, but in 1968, Jim Clark suffers an unfortunate accident and dies on the track.
Yes.
I believe it was in practice.
Yeah.
And now this is let's talk about this for just a moment, because there was a lot of criticism of Chapman. You're going to hear a lot about this in some of the posts that you read, or you know, some of the historical sites that you read,
or
but
forums or whatever.
But the thing is, like, now
he was driving just for the record, one of the reasons you'll hear that, Clark was driving a Lotus F8 or 48 F2.
Okay, so he's in a Lotus car, and this is practicing. I think he was in Hockenheim or something like that. He was practicing for the Grand Prix that was, you know, that weekend or whatever. Here's the strange thing is that, you know, there's a lot of mention that you know, Colin Chapman was not concerned with spectators. He didn't really care to. He didn't care how many people were at the audience or in the race.
Yeah,
watching. He didn't care, and he was. And they say that he was not concerned with the safety of the drivers. And
that is an accusation.
He preferred lightness over safety. Okay, that's something that you'll read often.
Yeah,
here's the thing that you know, that comes out. If you don't read beyond that, you would never know the real reason behind this. You have to go a little bit deeper to realize that. At the time, this is in the 1960s, late 1960s.
Sure.
And we've mentioned this in other cars too, in the Porsche 917 podcast.
Yeah.
The cars from the 60s and the 1970s were just, they were outright fast, not really built for safety in any case.
They were unapologetically performance vehicles.
Exactly. Yeah. These were cars that were built for speed, and they were considerably light. Ridiculously fast, and you know, like they put the driver at risk. But that's the way racing had always been to that point.
Right. It's not like he's the bad guy in this field of incredibly concerned car manufacturers.
No. And here's the thing: like, you know, Chapman was at one point charged with this is an unrelated event, but he was charged with manslaughter at one point in his racing career. In the death of a driver of his called his name was Joachim Rent. Yakim?
Yakim.
I think. Right. Rent. R-E-N-T. And the driver had an unfortunate accident on the track and died. But the thing is, they claim that Chapman made unsafe cars. And that's not the case. That's not true. Mm-hmm. You have to read deeper, like I said, and find out that this was every manufacturer's making
cars. Right, in the context of the time.
In a similar way.
Yeah.
And, you know, the problem was it just wasn't safe. And one of the people that spearheaded this issue was Jackie Stewart. And a lot of people know Jackie Stewart from his announcing days probably.
Right.
But he was, of course, a championship driver, Formula One. Mm-hmm. He was seeing – and this is – for a long, long time, but in the late 1960s and early 70s, he saw a lot of friends of his die on the track. And they were all Formula One drivers, but, you know, wrecks that shouldn't have been fatalities that were.
So
it's not just Chapman. Mm-hmm. It's not just Lotus. It's everybody. And there was a big push that was led by Jackie Stewart for safety around that time. I don't know if it was the late 60s or early 70s, but I know Jackie Stewart was a big proponent of safety in Formula One. Mm-hmm. And that's what really led to a lot of the advances that we see today, even now.
Yeah.
But it made it a much, much safer sport because they were losing drivers, it seemed like, every weekend or every, mm-hmm. Maybe every month. But there were many, many fatalities in Formula One. And, Clark was one of them, unfortunately. So,
he didn't die in vain, however, because this does lead to a dramatic, you know, we can't really call it a retooling of racing safety mm-hmm. because it is more like an original beginning of racing safety.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, motoring fans have probably heard the name Stirling Moss before, right?
Yeah.
Stirling Moss drove Lotus Formula One cars for a while. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. He said that he mentioned in one interview that I heard that they were beautiful, but they were, and he quoted this, they're delicate to drive.
I like that.
And he said that, you know, it's that they were extremely quick, mm-hmm. lightning fast. But, you know, you do something wrong, it's gonna let you know immediately what you did wrong.
Yeah.
And, that may be the case of a wheel falling off, mm-hmm. something like that. I mean, it was a major, major problem, but you had to know how to drive the car in order to do it safely or most efficiently for it to work.
Well, the handling itself is not very forgiving on any car at the speeds they were going at.
No.
Can we talk about, I don't want to roll over you, man. I want to talk about another thing that Chapman did that influenced racing, and a huge one, in the Indianapolis 500. Remember this? He got the rear engine mm-hmm. in the Indianapolis 500.
Yes, big innovation.
Which was huge because for a long time, you know, you'll read some people who say that the Indianapolis 500 was being a little bit stodgy. A little bit of an old man about improvements in tech. I can see both sides of the story, but the fact of the matter is that Colin Chapman, whether by bullying or sweet talk, possibly bullying, got the rear engine in there.
I think it's more of that. Yeah, sure. Yeah, because there's a lot of innovation that's happened at Indy over the years.
Yeah.
And he's one of these players that's a major innovation to bring the rear engine car.
It changes everything about the way a car drives.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's a big deal at the time. So, you know, if you get a chance, just Google Jim Clark. Take a look at the cars that he was driving, the way they look, and they're mm-hmm. just fantastic. They're the green cars with the yellow stripe down the middle, the rear engine.
Mm-hmm.
These are what I think of, you know, when I think of what an Indy car looks like now. Not now, but you know what I mean.
When someone says Indy car, it reminds
me of my old slot car.
Yeah.
That I have, you know.
Check out our slot car episode too.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? There's one other thing here that I should mention because, you know, there's a partnership with John Player that Chapman had for a while for the Formula One team. The John Player special cars.
Yeah.
The black cars with the gold trim.
Black and gold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Black and gold. I had a slot car that had that trim painted on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one of the coolest things that I had or one of the coolest things that I owned. But I remember those cars as being, you know, the cars of the day, you know, for Formula One. And there's some kind of neat photos online too if you search for Colin Chapman or John Player special or whatever, you can find, you know, not only photos of that car, but, you know, maybe a photo of Chapman leaning against a Lotus Esprit. I think the one I'm thinking of is a gold Esprit, and then that's parked in front of a black airplane that has, you know, John Player special painted on the side, and it's black with the gold trim. It's really a neat photo.
And that kind of partnership that leads to that iconic photo, that comes from a part of the financial world of racing because, as you know intimately, if you are professionally involved with racing, as you may have a sneaking suspicion if you're a race fan, race cars are expensive to maintain, to create, to not have wreck, you know, and, one of the things we see Chapman doing throughout his story is finding opportunities for funding. And he made one of the – I think that partnership with Imperial Tobacco, which led to the John Player Specials, was one of the biggest sponsorship deals of the day.
I could see that.
Because they ended up – you know, at the time, tobacco companies had a lot – this is before all the lawsuits and everything. They have quite a bit of capital.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that part off – I did want to – let's see. I wanted to hit up – there was one more, Scott. I wanted to surprise you. Oh, wait. Do you know about the turbine-powered car?
I think I do, but hit me with some of the details.
Oh, you're so hard to surprise.
That's all right. No.
Oh, no. That's why you're – that's why you're the auto editor. So in 1968, they have a turbine-powered car, and we have a podcast on turbine-powered cars for any interested listeners. The race that they had it in – led to turbine powered cars as a category being banned by the USAC.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just wanted to throw that in.
I want to say it was Sebring. Maybe it wasn't. I'm not sure, but, I think it was something like that. Mm. But yeah, it's an unusual looking car to say the least.
It's a weird design. I would love it if people would check out our turbine powered, car podcast if you're interested because, you know, there are some definite design flaws with that, but there are some really innovative things in there too. Now when we continue, we led up to, I think we've sort of led up through Colin Chapman's life here and the birth of Lotus and some of the notable things they've done with that.
Sure. I just want, just one quick thing is that, you know, this is a team that competed in Formula One from you gotta understand this from 1958 till about 1994.
Makes it a dynasty.
It really does, and they I would say they dominated F1 racing from 61 to about 81. They had about a 20-year stretch of Formula One racing where it was just Lotus. Really,
shutout.
It really was. I mean, and up until I don't know, up until that time, until 61, from about the 1920s, you've got the Germans, the Italians, and in some cases the French, more or less dominating the series.
Yeah.
And it kind of was a sense of national pride if your driver was doing well in the Grand Prix series.
Mm-hmm.
So the Germans were very proud of the Grand Prix drivers, and the Italians likewise, and the French likewise. But, you know, nothing like this had ever been seen at the time. And that's when Chapman kind of arrived on the scene with these light cars that were stylish.
Mm-hmm.
They were modern. They were exciting. And, you know, combined with the right driver, they were winners.
Yes. And, let's see, we've hit on how fundamental this man's role is, not just in the Lotus engineering, but also in racing in general. Not completely perfect. Made some bad moves with DeLorean.
Yeah. We should mention it and look into it yourself because I don't know many of the details on this. I didn't dig into that too deep. But unfortunately, he was involved in the DeLorean scandal in, 1981? Something
like
that?
Yeah. In the early
81,
80s.
82.
Yeah. And we will end with Colin Chapman passed away of a heart attack in 1982. However, he was still at Formula One in that year.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And if you want a little update on what's going on with Formula One, I think it's important to know too that Lotus is coming back, Ben. Yeah. Now they've always been around. You know, had their road cars. They've had the the production vehicles that they've maintained from the beginning all the way through now. And we didn't really talk a whole lot about, you know, like the the Lotus 7 that they produced.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
I've got numbers here, but that was the Lotus 7 that everybody calls it a Lotus 7 anyways, but the Lotus 7 was actually produced by Lotus only for a very short number of years. I mean, from 1957 until 1973.
I did not know that.
That it's not really a Lotus. I mean, you can get one now.
Mm-hmm.
You're buying what is essentially a kit car from the rights to that brand or that vehicle were sold to Caterham in 1973. And everything from that point on has been a Caterham or a kit car version. So if you got one that's, from between 1957 and 1973, then you've got a real Lotus.
Congratulations.
Exactly. And, a number of other successful vehicles. We mentioned the Esprit, the Europa.
Mm-hmm.
They've got the Elise now. They've got the Evora, which is one of the new ones. But they're making a comeback into racing now, Ben. For 2010 and 2011, there's a company called Team Lotus, which was formerly Lotus Racing.
Okay.
And they've got a Formula One team, which made its debut in 2010. And it's a group of Malaysian businessmen. And they've got a license rather from the Lotus car owner, which is, the parent company's name, Proton.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's how they race in Formula One. But this year, for 2011, that license is terminated, and the team is going to use the historic Team Lotus name for the 2011 season.
That's awesome.
And but the thing is, they've got a little bit of legal action that they're kind of going through right now from the group Lotus and Proton over the use of the Lotus name. But
I hope they get to.
I do too. But the cars are designed to look like the old John Player specials that we had mentioned.
No way.
Yeah, they're the black cars with the gold trim, and I think it's Renault is who the another sponsor. Wait, am I right on that? Maybe not. But again, they're the the very similar look to the John Player specials that you can find from the late 70s.
That's
early
awesome.
70s, I guess, maybe.
We've got to stay tuned. I want to see pictures of that.
Quite a bit going on.
Do you want to do some listener mail?
Why not?
All right, Scott, just to make sure that we got that year out, the time of Colin Chapman's passing was December 1982.
Very good.
Just to make sure. That's not listener mail.
I was wondering.
We do have great listeners, but none of them has written us back that early. That would be scary, wouldn't it?
No, during the podcast?
Yeah, that'd be someone with the shining right
that's
there.
That's right.
All right, so we've got a listener mail that is from an oldie but a goodie. David writes in from the internet, and David says, "Hey, I like your podcast." That's nice of you, David. And he's like, "I listened to your July episode, 2010, Scott, of Unusual Races." And he was at Houston International Festival, and they were having wiener dog races. Now, we've mentioned before, your pet.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yes, wiener dog. Gotta love it.
So they were running – these dogs were running in heats of three dogs each. And one heat was a previous year's winner, a very large dog, some other nondescript dog. Large dog was easily the size of the other two combined. They're off. The large dog started plodding straight down the track to the owner. The nondescript kind of dog kind of wandered off into the crowd looking for a handout. The previous year's winner went like a laser beam to about 10 feet from the finish, made a hard left, and ran to someone else in the crowd. The large dog took a full minute to finish the 10-second race, but won the heat as the crowd was going wild. The chubby didn't fare so well in his next
chubby?
Heat.
He called him chubby?
He called him chubby.
That's funny. I call my dog chubby too.
And so I just wanted to knock that one out because that's a pretty good point.
If honestly, Ben.
Yeah.
It is so funny to watch wiener dog races. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the ears. It's just the short legs, what it is. I mean, I'm biased, of course, because I've got a wiener dog, but little Arnie.
Yeah.
Arnie's a good
big shout out to Arnie.
Yeah, that's right. But he's not in marathon shape right now. I'll tell
not
you that.
Yet.
No, not yet.
Okay. Well, we're gonna get him on a fitness program.
Maybe a treadmill.
But maybe is there a wiener dog treadmill? This could be our next big thing, Scott.
I've seen some dogs on a carousel before. It's kind of funny. Yeah, that's a good one. They just continue to walk as it spins, so they don't move.
We'll be like Colin and Colin team. You know what I mean? We'll hustle wiener dog races.
Not a bad idea. But if you get a chance, look it up online and watch a wiener dog race or two. It's very funny.
And while you're online, please do us a favor and check out some more info about Colin Chapman and the Lotus vehicles, especially if you want those stats that we couldn't squeeze in today.
Yes.
And since you're already online, please tell us what you think. If you have a Lotus story, we'd love to hear it. If you want to tell us about unusual races, we always love to hear those. Or if you have a suggestion for an upcoming topic, hit us up on Facebook, find us on Twitter, check out our blog. You may have heard of a little website called HowStuffWorks.com. Guess what? You can email us at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.